Okay, good. Now, perhaps the most important topic of all, the Eucharist this evening. You could say, with no exaggeration, that the Eucharist is the reason why we do everything we do in the church. It's the reason why we build the building. It's the reason why we pay the electric bill. It's the reason why we unlock the doors. It's the reason why there's a priest. It's the reason why you gather. No exaggeration. The Eucharist is the reason why we do what we do. And with a proper understanding of the Eucharist, you'll understand why we say that. At your interview, one of the questions that I'm going to ask you is, what is the Eucharist? And the very best answer is in one word and one word only. Jesus. If you understand what the Eucharist is, you'll be able to understand, you'll be able to answer just that simply. And it's this astonishing belief that I want to comb through here this evening with you. And it's breathtakingly simple and scandalously bold. We believe that that little host is actually him. Period. I could call off the rest of the class now and send you all home. But let's look at it backwards and forwards and from every possible angle that we have. But literally, he's not like spiritually there. He's not like mystically there. He's not in the bread. We believe that thing is actually him. Right there, right present. It's an astonishing belief that he's personally present, and it's under the appearance of bread and wine. Now let's take a closer look at that. Now, as a church, we say Jesus is present to us in many ways. Jesus himself said, where two or three are gathered in my name, I myself am present there. Who's heard that before? Okay. The church also teaches that whenever the scriptures are proclaimed, Jesus is mystically there. I went to visit my grandmom's house in Ohio once upon a time and rifled through some items in her attic and came across a letter written by a great-great-grandparent dated 1903. And as I was reading the letter about the hardships of life on the farm in Ohio 100-and-something years ago, you know, she was a kind of a presence there. She kind of came alive. Believe it or not, we also say that Christ is present in the person of the priest. When the priest says to you at Mass, "The Lord be with you," and you say, "and with your spirit," that dialogue is actually an acknowledgement on your part that you recognize there's a special presence in the person of the priest. These are all things we believe. But none of those presences is the same as Jesus present in the Eucharist. There are some churches, I've seen this before, where they have the pulpit on one side of the sanctuary and the altar on the other side of the sanctuary as if they're equal, as if Jesus is present in the Word the same as he's present in the Eucharist. He is not. There is no equal to his presence in the Eucharist, because in the Word there's a kind of mystical remembrance, kind of spiritual presence. But in the Eucharist, and the Eucharist alone, we say he's actually there. And by that I mean he's there like the same way I'm here for you now. Nothing at all is lacking. The Catholic Church teaches that this presence begins at what we call the moment of consecration. Raise your hand if you know what the moment of consecration is. Let's go through that, okay? Just for those who don't. You've been to Mass, you've seen the priest hold up the host and say, "This is my body," right? And they ring the bells. You've seen the priest hold up the chalice and he says, "This is my blood," and they ring the bells. That's the moment of consecration. When they ring those bells, it's a way of saying, "Hey, people, pay attention. This is important. Hey, you snoozing people out there, don't snooze. This is an important moment." We say from the moment of consecration, Jesus is present. A simple way of saying it is bread ceases to be bread. Wine ceases to be wine. The way that we teach it in our official teaching of the church is that he's present body and blood, soul and divinity. Here's from the Council of Trent. Who's ever heard of the Council of Trent? It's a council of the church. All the bishops of the world met together with the Pope. The year was 1546 to 1563, a long time ago. But they made this official and clear. A little quote here on your notes. "By consecration, bread and wine change their substance and become the body and blood of Christ. This is called transubstantiation. In these consecrated species, Christ himself is present, living and glorious in a true, real, substantial matter. Body, blood, soul, and divinity, the host and the chalice, are equal but different expressions. So let's talk about that for just a second. We say wheat changes their substance. Now, I don't want to get too philosophical on you here, but let's hold up this little page. And let me ask you a question. What is this stuff that I'm waving here before you? What's it made out of? It's paper, right? This stuff is paper. That's its substance. What's it look like? It's, I know it looks like paper, but try harder. Okay? What's it look like? What color is it?
White.
What shape is it? How much does it weigh? All these things, right? Okay. We say that this thing, its substance, is paper. Well, when we celebrate the Eucharist, what we say is the substance itself actually changes. What did it used to be?
Bread and wine.
Is it bread and wine anymore?
No.
I know that sounds crazy, and we're going to talk about this, but at least let me tell you this. If that doesn't strike you as a little bit weird, you're not listening. And we'll talk about how Jesus' first hearers thought this when they first heard it. But we get so accustomed to hearing about the body and blood of Christ and the Eucharist. And, you know, we have cities in our country named after the Blessed Sacrament. Corpus Christi, Texas. Sacramento, California. There's probably plenty of others. Cities named after the Blessed Sacrament. We're used to it in as much as people can be used to it. We begin to think nothing of it. And you almost need to hear this as if for the first time in order to get it. It should strike you as being a little bit weird. Because what we're saying contradicts every sense that you have. The word that we use to say that bread ceases to be bread and wine ceases to be wine is transubstantiation. I've got it in bold on your notes. It was a brand new word. The church made it up because we needed to create a word to express something that nobody had ever expressed before. What word do you use to describe something that becomes something else? Transubstantiation. Now, occasionally, and I've got some stories of this here in your notes, not only does the substance change, not only does bread cease to be bread and wine cease to be wine, occasionally it even looks different. These are called Eucharistic miracles. Got a couple of them attached to your notes. You can read them at your leisure. But just for the sake of those who don't believe this or who doubt this, every once in a while God works a miracle for reasons known but to God. And I got a couple of them in your notes. One of them is called the Eucharistic Miracle of Lanciano. And it's the story of a priest who celebrated Mass and he wasn't really sure that he believed in the Eucharist. And lo and behold, while he was saying Mass, the substance of what was on the chalice and what was in the cup, it changed. And it's still there. You can go see it. I went to see it myself once upon a time when I was visiting Italy. And they did a study on this material, this substance that was once bread and wine. And they found it to be human blood tissue, type AB positive. And they found that what was once the host was cardiac tissue, tissue from a human heart. Then there's another one, which I included just because it's contemporary, the Eucharistic Miracle of Buenos Aires. The reason why I included that partially is because the bishop who was in charge of the diocese at the time that miracle took place was the one who later became Pope Francis. And it's this amazing story. 1996, the priest picked up a host, and I don't know all the details of it, but they ended up sending this host to a lab in New York City with no information whatsoever as to where it had come from. Because the priest recognized, it wasn't a host anymore. It was bloody. It was fleshy. And the lab in New York City, who had no idea what it was, said, this is human heart tissue. This is human blood type AB positive. And they, just for fun, I'll tell you more. They said, do you know anything else about the miracle? And they say, well, whatever we can say about this heart tissue is that the subject from which this heart tissue was taken was undergoing terrible, terrible distress and strain at the time. So how do you know? Well, there's this chemical present in the blood and an incredibly high white blood cell count, something along those lines, that show that he must have been something terribly, terribly distressed at the time. And they say, like, what kind of distress? Oh, like, for example, when someone's trying to kill you. And this is of some lab at like Cornell University or something like that. So go ahead and read those. They're rare. God doesn't work miracles every day. But occasionally he'll allow a miracle for the sake of people who have a hard time believing. But what we say is, in all the other instances, it still looks like a host. It still tastes like a host. It still weighs like a host. It still measures like a host. It still looks like a chalice. It still has the consistency of wine. In every other way, it appears to be the same. But what do we say? Is it the same after the words of consecration? Answer, no, it is something else. So, for example, I'll be helping Mass, and maybe someone will be helping me give out communion. And occasionally, a Eucharistic minister who helps the priest give out communion when they really have a great need will say something like, am I giving out the bread today? And I cringe when I hear that. I'm like, do you know what you're giving? If you did, you wouldn't use that word. You can say host, you can say Christ, you can say Eucharist, but please, for the sake of my trust in you, don't call it bread, okay? But that's what we believe. From the moment of consecration, something's there that was never there before. Jesus is actually, really, substantially, truly, and personally present. Okay, now a few more things to make this clear. In Mass, the priest has two consecrations. Have you noticed? One is on a piece of bread. The other is on a cup of wine. Now, people think that, like, that's half of Jesus in the bread and the other half of Jesus in the cup. And I want to make it clear that it's not. You may one day go to a parish in which they give out the Eucharist in a chalice. I used to do that at my previous parish. I'll never do it again, ever. The reason for that is because people inevitably spill. And I cannot stand it. I just can't stand it. Once you know what's in that cup, you can't bear the fact that somebody accidentally spilled it, and now it's, you know, down in the cracks of the floor between a couple of tiles. Can't do it again, ever again. But people think that, like, if they don't drink from the chalice, that they're missing something, as if you get half of Jesus in the host and half of Jesus in the chalice. Is Jesus divided in two?
No.
When you receive from the host, are you receiving the entirety of Christ?
Yes.
When you receive from the chalice, are you receiving the entirety of Christ?
Yes.
If you receive from the host and the chalice, are you receiving communion twice?
No.
Yes.
Yes.
I heard everybody say yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. You are receiving communion twice. So, but please understand, you're not missing anything. There are some people who only receive from the cup. Do you know that? A couple of people with very, very severe this or that disorder. And they ask the priest, especially before Mass, will you prepare a cup? And I can't take a host. And they don't take the host at all. Are they receiving communion? Are they missing anything? Please understand that. That's called the principle of concomitance, just in case you're curious. Some people say, well, you know, why two consecrations at all? It's emblematic of the fact that on the cross, body and blood were divided, and that was Jesus' death. Okay? But please understand, nothing is lacking. It's just kind of a common mantra you'll hear. Sometimes people say, well, I didn't receive the blood of Christ. You received the host, you received the whole of Christ. Nothing lacking whatsoever. Okay. There's a lot of little points here that I need to make just to help kind of bolster this one big point that I'm making. As long as the appearances of bread and wine remain, Christ is there. So if I take a host and I break it in half, are you getting half of Jesus? So occasionally you'll go to Mass and the priest will run out of host and you have to break the thing into bits and pieces. Is every bit and piece the Eucharist whole and entire? Yes. Now, sometimes people, and very often, I'm sorry to say, people receive massively irreverently. I can't stand it, but the church requires me to allow people to receive in the hand, which I personally hate, but, you know, I'm not allowed to tell you that you can't do it. Part of the reason why I hate it is because people receive it and then they'll smash it with their thumb before picking it up, and they'll break right there in their hand. Is every piece in their hand that's broken still the Eucharist? Now you can see why I hate it. Believe me, I give out a lot of hosts. It happens a lot. We'll talk about how to receive communion later, but I'm not allowed to tell you that you can't receive in the hand, but I don't think it's a good idea. There's a reason why we have a great tradition of receiving on the tongue. Another thing to remember, when you receive the host, they say it's in you for 15 minutes. I say here in your notes, remember that when you're in the parking lot. Okay? Be good to people. Now, Those are a few little ways of looking at the Eucharist. When you say this to people, people that aren't in RCIA, people that aren't necessarily trying to become Catholic or receive sacraments or learning for the first time, there's a number of different reactions. A couple of reactions are, you're crazy, or you're very, very badly mistaken. If you're crazy to say this, well, I would say at least you're paying attention, because it really does sound crazy. And I'll talk about why we're not very, very badly mistaken. But you may want to consider this question: why did Jesus do this? And I can only give you a speculative answer as to why he did it. One of my favorite responses to the question, why did Jesus come up with the Eucharist, came not from a Catholic, but from an Anglican. C.S. Lewis, who you probably heard of from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, yes? He's also a great Christian writer, if you haven't read him before. Great Christian writer, but he once said, Jesus gave the apostles the Eucharist, and he did not say to them, take this, all of you, and understand it. He said, take this, all of you, and eat it. I like that because ultimately, when you're talking about God, you're talking about the depths of the mysteries of love. And they're mysteries that are simply beyond basic human comprehension. If you don't realize that you're getting into something bigger than your mere comprehension, then you don't realize what you're getting into yet, or you're in for a big surprise, or you're in for a big shock. But please be aware, God's bigger than any of us. We can partly understand why he does what he does, but never fully. But the best partial understanding that I've been able to come up with is this. If God is love, what does love want from the one that they love? Love wants union. Okay? I love ice cream. What do I do with my ice cream? I become one with the ice cream. Right? I become one with the ice cream. Right? If I love a donut, I become one with the donut. I unite myself to the donut. Well, if you love another person, you become as close as you can be, but there are limits. You're still you, and he, she is still he, she. You're still two different people. There's only but so close you can get, you know, based on just laws of physics, unless you're God. If you're God, you can get even closer. And God did. He found a way to get closer to us than we could ever get to one another. He actually found a way to become our food. If you understand love and the desire for oneness and union, that begins to make a little bit of sense, and it's my best stab as to why Jesus did this, okay? But sometimes, people hear about the Eucharist and they're fascinated. They think it's the most amazing idea in the whole world. St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, if you haven't heard of her, I'll tell you a story of her life. She was an Anglican. She lived in New York City from one of America's wealthiest families around the year 1800 and something, a couple hundred years ago. And she heard this story that, you know, on a trip to Italy, she was told that when people are sick, the priest brings Jesus to them. And she thought, what? That's the most amazing thing I've ever heard. Jesus actually comes to you when you're sick. And it was her understanding of the Eucharist that made her start to learn more and more about the Catholic faith. And of course, she became a Catholic and a canonized saint. When I was in Spain as a student, we went to these churches and we saw these amazing monstrances. Who knows what a monstrance is? Who does not know what a monstrance is? Okay, who's heard of Adoration of the Blessed Sacrament? Who's never heard of Adoration of the Blessed Sacrament? Okay, there's probably too much for me to tell. But one of our devotions is we can actually place the host inside of a little container for you to pray, and you can see the host. And the container is called a monstrance. Not a monster, but a monstrance. It comes from the Latin word monstrare, which means to show. And you might have seen a picture of one of these monstrances. If you haven't, you soon will. They're all gold. They look like the rays of the sun. Does that sound familiar to anybody? Okay, let me continue. In Spain, they have monstrances to end all monstrances. They have monstrances that are 7-8 feet tall. And they're gold carving angels, intricate sunbeams, bursts of rays, and amazing, breathtaking works of art. And I was a student in Spain with a bunch of non-Catholics, right? And we go up through the church, and they show the monstrance. It's the most amazing, beautiful gold carved thing you've ever seen in your life, like 8 feet tall. And the people say, what is that? And I say, well, that's a monstrance. And I say, well, what's it for? And I say, well, that's used to hold the Blessed Sacrament. And they say, what's the Blessed Sacrament? And I say, we believe it's Jesus. And it leads to this long discussion. And this is where I found either they think I'm crazy or they think the most amazing thing in the world. And among those who think that it's the most amazing thing in the world, and I hope that's all of you here, there's always a follow-up question. How do you know? I want to believe that too. Convince me. How do you know you're not wrong? That's what I want to go over now. Okay? How do you know you're not wrong? To answer that question, you want to ask three questions. Number one, what if Christians believed from the beginning? Because if we made this up somewhere down a long line, who cares? Okay? Number two, what did Jesus himself say about the matter? Number three, what about the people who believe this? How do they live their lives? Those are the three ways we answer the question, yes, this really is correct. We're not wrong about it. It really is him. Number one, what did Christians believe from the beginning? If we made this up somewhere along the line, then who cares? Just throw it out. You might have heard of, what's that author's name? Now I'm drawing a blank. She's that famous woman, Flannery O'Connor. You ever heard of Flannery O'Connor? Real sharp, sharp author from the 30s. And she was at a dinner party once upon a time, and somehow the subject turned to religion, and somehow the subject turned to the Eucharist, and they were trying to placate her as a Catholic by saying something like, well, you know, I think the Eucharist is just a really lovely symbol, really beautiful belief, really great idea. And they thought that was placating her. And Flannery O'Connor shot back in the pleasantries of a dinner party, if the Eucharist is just a symbol, well, then I say the hell with it. Because why bother, right? If we made it up somewhere along the line, then the hell with it. Who cares? But it turns out that there's a written record, and I included these in your notes. You can look them over, some of the oldest written records. That for 1,000 years, nobody questioned this. Now think about that. There's no record of protest of anybody saying, this isn't the real presence of Christ. This is an age in which people are being killed for their faith. There's no room for ambiguity. There's no room for innovation or falsehood. If it's not true, they don't want to believe it because their lives are on the line. We have a record of the first person ever to willingly question the presence of Christ in the Eucharist, and they can even name him. His name is Berengarius of Tours. The year in which he first wrote, well, maybe it's not really Christ, maybe it's just a symbol, was 1088. Now, that's a long time. That's 1,000 years. Think of how different the world has become between now and the year 1026. It's a lot of time. And even he died reconciled with the church. So the fact of the matter is, from the beginning, people believed that host is actually him. That's what we've received. The innovation that came along centuries and centuries later was that, well, it's just a symbol. It's just a pious memorial. That's the novelty. Unfortunately, history and the written record is unanimously on that side. Secondly, what did Jesus himself say about this matter? If you're a cradle Catholic, like I said, it's very, very familiar for you to say, you know, the body of Christ and the Eucharist, and it's very, very familiar. But if you ever stop to think about how crazy it sounds, a couple little examples for you here in your notes. Can you imagine Martin Luther King or Abraham Lincoln getting up and giving a speech in which they're carrying along their audience, you know, on a wave of rhetorical and oratorical skill and prowess, and then suddenly, in the midst of beautiful phrase, they say, and unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in you. You'd stop, you'd say, what did you just say? Did I misunderstand? Was there a glitch? Did the microphone break? I mean, is something wrong? Jesus was teaching large, vast crowds, and you can read this in yourself. The place in which this is best covered is John chapter 6. There are several places in the scriptures that talk about this, but the clearest is in John chapter 6. And John chapter 6 takes place after the multiplication of the loaves and the fishes. Has everybody heard of the multiplication of the loaves and the fishes? And he had thousands and thousands of people there, but there was only a couple dried fish and a handful of barley loaves, and he fed thousands of people, and everybody recognized it was a miracle, and everybody followed him after it was over, because they all thought, this at last is the prophet who's been promised to come into the world. This is the one we've all been waiting for. Jesus turns to the crowds and says, you're following me because you had your fill of loaves. You're following me because you gave, because I gave you physical bread. I want to give you the bread that lasts until eternal life. People are intrigued. They say, oh, what's the bread that lasts to eternal life? And Jesus says, I am the bread of life. And the people say, well, that's kind of a strange thing to say. Maybe you're speaking metaphorically. And Jesus repeats himself. I myself am the bread of life. If anyone eats this bread, he shall live forever. The bread that I shall give is my flesh for the life of the world. People say, you had me and you lost me, Jesus. You had me and you lost me. They became annoyed. They say, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? And Jesus doesn't correct himself. Jesus doesn't explain himself. Jesus doesn't back down. Jesus rather doubles down and puts even greater emphasis on the words. And I got a little quote for you here in the scriptures. Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in you. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up on the last day. My flesh is real food. My blood is real drink. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood lives in me, and I in him. And for those of you who like grammar and words and history, and that, I even throw a little bit of Greek for you, because originally this was written in Greek. He changes the word, Jesus himself changes the word eat, as he says this, from one Greek word to another. The first word is phagein, and the other is trogein. Phagein means to eat. Trogain means gnaw and chew, like a wolf chewing flesh off a bone. He wants to make it absolutely clear. Unless you gnaw and chew on my body and blood, you have no life in you. He's real blunt. Now understand, these people that are already following him, these people who already believe, and they say, well, this sort of talk is hard to accept. Who can possibly take it? Now, every time Jesus has been misunderstood, in the past, he always explains himself. He explained himself in the parable of the sower. He explained himself in the parable of the talents. He explained himself at the death of Lazarus. Jesus doesn't explain himself here because there was nothing to explain. He meant exactly what he said. 12 times he says, he's the bread come down from heaven. 4 times he says, eat my flesh, drink my blood. He meant exactly what he said. Now here's the clincher. This is something he couldn't afford to get wrong, because in the Old Testament, it was forbidden to eat flesh and drink blood. It's in the book of Leviticus. Little story that I can tell you from my own knowledge, my own life. I knew a guy once. He was doing an environmental studies course in Kenya. And part of his course had him living in the bush, in the wilds of Kenya, with the Kenyan tribesmen. And they had a ceremony at night. They all sat around a campfire and they passed around the blood of a newly killed gazelle. And they all drank the blood of the gazelle. No worries about health or anything like that. They all drank the blood of the gazelle. And he said, why do you drink the blood of the gazelle? And he goes, because the blood is the life of the beast and we want to get the speed of the gazelle. Now that's why Leviticus said, don't eat flesh and drink blood. Among pagan peoples, apparently this has been a belief for centuries and centuries and centuries. If you drink the blood of the beast, you get the spirit of the beast. Drink the blood of the ox, get the strength of the ox. Drink the blood of the gazelle, get the speed of the gazelle. The blood was the life. Now, if anybody can edit the Bible, it's God. I'm going to take just a guess here and say part of the reason in which Jesus did this is that that's one spirit we want to drink in. We want the spirit of the living God in us. That's the entire point. But when Jesus said this, people got up and walked away. There are many that says who no longer continued in his company. It's the only time anybody ever walked away from Jesus for doctrinal reasons and just for fun. Do you know the line in scriptures in which the people walk away from Jesus because they won't believe in the Eucharist? I just think this is cool. John 6, verse 66. John 6, 6, 6. And many walked away from him and no longer continued in his company. And when they walked away, what did Jesus do? Did he say, wait, stop, guys, don't leave. No, I was only speaking figuratively. No, don't leave me, please, come back. No. He turned to his apostles and he says, you can leave me too? Which means he meant exactly what he said. And Peter answered him, he said, Lord, where would we go? You have the words of eternal life. So, it's weird. It's strange. It's hard to understand. It contradicts your reason. It contradicts your senses. If you struggle with this, I can't fault you. But there's one fact we can't deny, and that is that Jesus himself said it. And we have a way of believing that when he says it, he means it. A couple things in your notes here. If an umpire says, you're out, then guess what? You're out, because he said so. If the cop says, you're under arrest, I don't care how you interpret his words. The fact is, he has the authority, and as soon as he says it, you are, in fact, under arrest. And when God says, let there be light, guess what? There is light. And when God says, this is my body, this is my blood, guess what? It is. Thomas Aquinas, who everybody's heard of, correct? Wrote a song that you might hear. It's called the Adoro Te Devote. You might someday hear this in a church once. Adoro Te Devote. I won't get into all of it. But there's a line in the song in which Thomas Aquinas speaks about the Eucharist. He says that seeing, touching, hearing, they're all, seeing, touching, tasting are all deceived. Only hearing is to be believed. Truth himself speaks truly, or there's nothing true. Those are the lines of the song. So why do we believe it? Because Jesus said it. And I'm rather out of explanations to bolster that. But I can tell you so far that, in fact, it makes sense to believe it. It's plain as black and white in the scriptures. And we believed it from the very beginning. Now, the last one of all, the lives of those who believe. By their fruit, you'll know the value of a tree. It turns out that for as long as records have been kept, there is not one example, not even one example of a saint who was not devoted to the Blessed Sacrament. Not even one. And I've talked to you about the saints before and how great their lives were and how greatly good they are and how the greatness of their lives really, really begs for an explanation. How it leads you to ask the question, either these people were believing in something true, or they're the most deluded of all fools. But the great, great goodness of their lives tells you they were onto something. And all these saints, Saint Cyprian writing in the 3rd century, Christians in prison would want the Blessed Sacrament so they wouldn't deny their faith. Give me communion, they said, so that I will be able to resist. Okay. As I've mentioned before, you judge a medicine by those who take it, not by those who don't. Many people who condemn the Christian faith, condemn the Catholic faith, in fact condemn a lack of the Catholic faith. They condemn people who blatantly violate it. They condemn people who don't live up to what it teaches. But there are some who did. They're greatly, greatly good. They're proof of the truth of what we say. They're proof that it can be lived. It's not impossible. And they all happen to have one funny thing in common. They all believed in the truth of the Blessed Sacrament. And that's evidence to the truth of what we believe. Okay? That's evidence to the truth of what we believe. Another little corollary of this is that if you believe this, you will be set for life spiritually. Because if you believe that he's really there, you'll never leave the Catholic faith. If you believe that he's really there, you will always have a place to turn. If you believe that he's really there, you'll never wander somewhere else. But where would you wander? I knew a priest once upon a time actually left the priesthood and became a Mormon. And a priest brought him back to the faith and to the priesthood by asking, how can you turn your back on the Eucharist? And he didn't have an answer for it. So you got to ask yourself this question and continually ask yourself this question. Do you believe it? And how much do you believe it? A little story to share with you here. A priest I know tells me this story of a priest who's saying Mass, and he consecrates the host, and he puts the host down on the altar, and along comes a church mouse. scurries along the altar, takes the host in his mouth, runs away to his hole. True story. Question. Did the mouse consume a Eucharist? Yes or no? Yes. Did the mouse consume that which had become the body and blood of Christ? Yes. Question. Did the mouse experience communion with the living God? No. Just a church mouse. Okay? God himself has a sense of humor. These things happen. Okay? It happens. But the priest went on to have a little meditation, and he titled it this way. He said, are you a man or a mouse? When you receive communion, do you scurry away back into your hole like nothing happened? When you receive communion, do you just forget about it and become angry in the parking lot before Mass is over? How do you receive? How well do you receive? How much do you think about it? You can meditate on this for your whole life. But let me ask you this. It goes back to what I said about the sacraments earlier. God gives everything, but how much do you cooperate and participate? You have to ask yourself that all the way. In your notes here, as I've got this, that same priest asked the following disturbing question. Do you have more faith in a bottle of Tylenol than you have in the Blessed Sacrament? Because if you take a Tylenol, you darn well expect something to happen. If you take a Tylenol and nothing happens, you shake the bottle and wonder, what went wrong. But plenty of people receive the Eucharist and they don't expect anything to happen. And you got to ask, how deep is their faith? You got to ask, how deep is your faith? You can have a lifetime of growth in this. But it's a worthy meditation. How much do you believe? How deeply do you believe? Can you believe more and more deeply? It'll only lead to your happiness, holiness, sanctification, and eternal life. The deeper you appreciate and understand this. A few final points. Effects of the Eucharist. It brings the body under control of the spirit. It's the single best means of growing in temperance, chastity, patience, and every other virtue. God desires this very much. It's a very pleasing act to God. We don't often think of that terms, do we? We often think in terms of what's it going to do for me. We don't often think in terms of God being in a relationship who loves us, and this really, really pleases the one we love. If we thought more like that, I think our faith would be a lot deeper. It's very, very pleasing to God that we receive well the Eucharist. Every time you receive the Eucharist, sanctifying grace in your soul is increased. A few guidelines for receiving the Eucharist that people don't often think about. Number one, not everybody should go, and this isn't said frequently enough. St. Paul, in his first letter to the Corinthians, says, if you eat and drink unworthily, you eat and drink a damnation on yourself. Do not receive the Eucharist if you're in the state of mortal sin. Don't do it. Go to confession first. If you want, you can come up to the priest with your arms crossed, the universal sign for don't give me the Eucharist, give me a blessing. But don't take communion if you're in serious sin. Okay? Just don't do it. You don't want that on your conscience. Go to confession as soon as you possibly can. It's a serious sacrilege. Number two, and people don't often think about this, Eucharistic fast. Now, fast in quotation marks. It's almost nothing. Fast is an hour. You know what that means? That means don't snack as you're driving to church. It's not much to ask. Really, this is one of these many, many examples in which the church has made things too easy. It used to be that it was from midnight before until you received communion, which is why Mass was always in the morning, right? Because you wanted to have something to eat. And then later they made it 3 hours, which makes you stop and think about it. Now it's an hour and it's almost a joke. But, I'm not in charge. If I was the Pope, everything would be perfect, right? But that's the way things are. You can have medicine, don't let that get in your way. Okay. Another thing people don't often realize, Protestants and non-Catholics shouldn't get communion. Now this always throws people for a loop. Why can't I get communion if I'm not a Catholic? Why can't I get communion if I'm not baptized? Why can't I get communion if I'm a Protestant? I believe that it's really Jesus. Well, let me expand your understanding a little bit of the Eucharist. It's not enough for you just to say, I believe it. Certainly it's required, but it's not enough. Because another major important part of the Eucharist is understanding not what the Eucharist is, but what the Eucharist means. It's an important question to ask. What does this mean? It is the body and blood. It is Christ himself, but It means union. If you're not in union with the church, you contradict what it means. That's why you shouldn't. I mean, it's not like the whole world comes to a screeching halt if you do, but most people want to do the right thing. Most people don't want to do the wrong thing. You know, if you go visit Jerusalem and you go to the Wailing Wall, they make you put on a little hat before you go. And most people just want to do the right thing. People always take it personally as if, like, God doesn't love Protestants. No, it's more like this. If I was, let's say, in the army, and I wasn't a sergeant, but I wore sergeant's stripes, I would weaken the meaning of those stripes because it wouldn't be real. And every time, I don't know, you saw those stripes, you'd wonder, well, is that a real sergeant or not? Well, the meaning of the Eucharist is that there's a union. And every time somebody who contradicts that, the meaning is weakened. And that hurts us all. So no, you're not supposed to receive communion if you're a Protestant. And it doesn't mean Jesus doesn't love you. It just means that Jesus himself was the one who established this as a sacrament that means union. Okay? And since ancient times, we've always understood this. In fact, in the ancient church, I think I might have mentioned this to you before, and if not, I bet you Father John mentions it next week when you learn about the Mass. If you weren't a Catholic, you couldn't even stay for the part of the Mass in which they consecrated the host and the chalice in the first place. After the readings, the priest would say, the doors, and everybody who wasn't a Catholic would go away. And they closed the doors. I mean, now you can hang around, but please, Eucharist only for people who have made their first communion. You're not supposed to go until you've made your first communion, and that's all that. Last little thing I throw in here just for fun. How many times a day can I receive communion? Twice. We actually have a rule. I suppose if we didn't have a rule, you get some very pious and prayerful people, just go to communion all day long, because they figure that, so the church says, no, just don't go more than twice, okay? So there's the Eucharist, a half an hour to learn, a lifetime to love.